Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is one of my most favourite and most considered broadcasters, a voice familiar to millions and yet whom we know relatively little about, which I think is exactly how she likes it. Extensive Google searches throw up very little about her, despite 30-plus years working very much in the public eye, with award-winning stints hosting The Breakfast Show alongside Nikki Campbell and The Lunchtime Show on 5 Live, as well as her work for Radio 4. One of seven children born to Irish Catholic parents in Liverpool, she rose through the ranks of the BBC and since leaving 5 Live in 2014 has been hosting her own daily afternoon show on LBC, getting a chance to exercise journalistic muscles and opinions previously contained by years of BBC impartiality. Today, I am thrilled that she's made an exception to offer up answers instead of questions, and even happier that we get to do this face-to-face. Sheila Fogarty, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kate. It's lovely to be here.
There is so little about you online, Sheila Fogarty. How the hell in 30 years have you managed that?
Do you know, it's not really a massively conscious decision. I'm probably, because I'm so radio, really, I probably just didn't get into the sort of visuals of everything in the way that maybe TV presenters did. I'm also not, even as a kid, my mum used to joke that, and there's evidence of it in photographs, that whenever someone took a picture of me, I would hold the end of my skirt and start to play with it anxiously. So I didn't like having my picture taken as a kid. I'm not massively keen on it now, to be honest.
I don't know why.
Because I'm an outgoing person and I'm a happy person and a smiley person. But I've got, remember that episode of Friends where Chandler and Monica go to have their engagement picture taken and Chandler just goes, he can't smile.
Grimaces.
Yeah. When somebody says to me, smile for the camera, I'm like,
do you score photo face?
I hate it. I have a terrible photo face. So maybe that's made me inhibited about it. But I'm not, I don't aim to be mysterious. So ask me anything.
Well, I will actually, I will with license, thank you, because I've followed you for years. I think we've interacted a few times on Twitter. You feel like a friend in my ear. You are somebody that I turn to, certainly in most recent years, a lot. Because whenever there's a big story, I trust you to take me through it, to give me the facts, to raise the right questions and to make me think and not tell me what to think.
Oh, that's nice.
And I think that is the nuance of great journalism, yeah, as opposed to these kind of shouty shock jocks that tell you what to think.
Well, it's funny because when LBC first approached me about working for them, I was like, are you sure?
Yeah.
Because I'm not a shock jock.
No.
And I don't really have that in me. Interestingly, though, in the 7 years that I've been with them.
Oh, it's changed a lot, the network.
It's changed, but I've changed as well doing it. I've exercised more muscles. And I thought, if you're going to do it, you know, if you're going to shed some of those BBC skins, then do it, you know, don't half do it. So I was never going to become a shock jock by any stretch of the imagination, but I do take people on a bit, you know. And
you do?
Well, you have to sometimes, don't you?
You do it so politely and you do it so well that I always come away impressed thinking, I always, you know, like Christians wear those bracelets that say, what would Jesus do? I want to be a bit more like, what would Sheila do? Honestly, your consideration in everything that you raise is really smart. And I think in so many ways, it comes from years of constraint at the BBC. I think it forces you to consider.
It does force you to consider. And I'm glad that I had those years as well, because you do... You know, I remember having a private conversation when I was still presenting The Breakfast Show at Five Live with Nikki. And I had a private conversation, which I know he won't mind me sharing, with Ed Balls. We were doing an event together about stammering. Because I had a little stammer when I was a kid. And before it, he said to me, ever the politician, you know, he said to me, you know, you're one of the few presenters who... he thought, you know, you're one of the few BBC presenters whose politics I just can't call. And I said, good. And I wasn't going to tell him anything, you know. And he said, but you must have, you know, with your background, of course, my background, Liverpool, Irish, working class, seven kids, da, 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 da. You know, he just assumed, why aren't you Labour? Why aren't you Labour? And I said, I'm not party political at all. And honestly, you could see, because of course, they're all so party political, you know.
I think it's in their blood. Yeah.
He couldn't understand the words that came out of my mouth. I said, I'm just not party political. And I said, I've voted all over the place. And you could see him going, why would you do that? How come? You know, he couldn't quite grasp that that was a possibility.
But you know what? I mean, the last few years, extraordinary times that we've lived through, Sheila. Mm. I think extraordinary times to be a storyteller. Has it reasserted in you your conviction to tell great stories?
Yeah, absolutely. But I tell stories, but more in this job, I'm almost the conduit for stories, really. I still tell them a bit when you do journalism about particular topics and stuff. And I've got some topics that are passions of mine, but it absolutely has. Are you talking about the pandemic in particular?
Talking about all of it. I mean, when you think about, you know, since 2020, we've lived through a pandemic, times of which were the most extraordinary.
Unimaginable, yeah.
And now we find ourselves, you know, observing the most horrific war in Europe with the Russian assault on Ukraine. And there is an information war that is being waged. And I think that gives value to journalism in a way that we've probably forgotten to value it in recent times because of the fluff and the showbiz and the hacking and everything else that sits around it.
But it's serious business. And I'll come back to the business of this period. I was conscious. People were often ringing me in distress or confusion or sorrow or isolation, loneliness. And there was only one story that we were covering, and it was that every day in all its variations, you know, but it was the only story. And it was a story. It was the only story I've ever covered where every single person is experiencing the same story. Mm. Now, they might be experiencing it differently, but they're all experiencing the same story. One story in particular that I'd covered previously had prepared me really well for this, which was Hillsborough. Now, the whole country didn't experience Hillsborough, really. Liverpool certainly did, and anybody who supported the fans did. But that covering that story, both as a very young journalist and then over years, really, over three decades, it taught me an awful lot about... I mean, it was the first story I ever covered, really. And I was in Radio Merseyside on the day it happened. And, you know, it taught me an awful lot about listening. It taught me a lot about... how important broadcast and newspaper offices at the time, you know, it's all online now, of course, and you can access them all day and night, but how important those local and national journalistic hubs were for people to come to and speak to and give their story to. However that's happening, it's important that it happens. And it taught me about the truth and how important it is to kind of try your level best to uphold it and to get to it. But most, you know, all kinds of elements in that story, I didn't realize it until I was doing it really 30 years later, prepared me for covering the pandemic and listening to people during the pandemic, because there was a lot of trauma there.
Yeah, it's exactly that connection that I made researching your story, which brings me really nicely to my first question for you. You were temping at Radio Merseyside the day that Hillsborough happened, that so many men, women, children went to see a football match and 97 of them did not come home.
Yeah.
That should never have happened.
Of course.
you heard firsthand by answering the phones there, the accounts from the people on the ground about what was happening. Mm. And you've been party to that conversation ever since. Mm. So I wanted to explore the importance of that and the fact that it is a 30-year fight for justice, mm. but also to ask you what other truly important conversations you've been privy to or a party to that have been life-changing.
Well, should I start with Hillsborough?
Let's start with Hillsborough.
You said there are, you know, you're right to say that I got a lot of calls on, you know, I was taking calls like everybody else was in the station. Bear in mind, I wasn't a journalist at that point. I was about to start my journalistic training.
You were temping, weren't you?
I was temping before I went to do my BBC training. And I just went in, I was working on reception and in the newsroom doing, you know, literally newsroom support stuff. And I popped in on the Saturday I first heard about Hillsborough in town. I was in town shopping and I overheard there was a guy, there used to be a guy who had a fruit stall in the centre, and he always had a transistor radio up really loudly with the match on, you know, whichever match it was. And I could see loads of people around the stall talking to him and, you know, all talking to each other. And, you know, you can see something is odd and not quite right. So I went, nosy, natural journalist. Yeah. Went,
but you know, something big's happening when people watch the radio, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When people watch the radio, something big is going down.
They were all going over to it. You know, and I thought, what's that? And then I said to the woman there, what's going on? And she said, oh, apparently there's been a wall or something has fallen down at the Liverpool game. And I thought, okay. So I just went to the station straight away just to find out really what was going on. And it would have been about, now bear in mind the thing happened at 3 o'clock.
Yeah, 3:15. In the afternoon.
And this would have been about 4:15, so a good hour had gone by. So by the time I got to the station, they already had a death figure of about 25, 26 people. And I walked into reception and the woman who was on reception said to me, oh, great, did someone call you? And I said, no, I'm just coming in to find out what's happening. She said, get behind here. So I was behind reception. And then that's when the whole thing just grew and grew and grew and grew, if, you know, before our eyes, really. And so that would have been 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And by about 8 in the evening, this is all pre-Twitter, by about 8 in the evening, Liverpool fans were coming from Sheffield and they were getting off their coaches and their trains and going straight to Radio Merseyside, straight to Radio City, and straight to the Echo.
To tell the truth,
To tell the truth, because they already knew what was happening.
Yeah.
And they were coming as individuals. They weren't en masse with a story to tell that would, you know, cover their asses. They were coming to tell, because they knew, because they told me. I knew what was happening. And then as the days went on, and the Sun newspaper had Hillsborough the truth, and, you know, all the politicians were lining up to say, hooligans, and foreign newspapers were doing the same. I'll never forget, there was I just graduated in Spanish and French, and the news editor at the time said, you speak a few languages, don't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, come with me. And he sat me at a desk with a phone and said, you're the foreign desk. I'm like, how glamorous. But he said, you're the foreign desk, because we were getting calls from all over the world about this story. And I'll never forget the front page of the Spanish newspaper called El País, which is a fairly highish brow paper. And it had one of the awful images from the Leppings Lane. And it said at the top, bestias ingleses, English beasts, you know? And I thought, God, you know, terrible. I mean, obviously most Brits weren't going to see that, thank God,
But it's not the point. The narrative should not have been there because they were victims.
Yeah, absolutely. But what was interesting, there's all of those people coming in and telling us their story. I didn't go home that night. Nobody went home that night. I went back home around about 2 the next day, and we all just stayed there and kept the doors open of the station, and people were coming in all day, all night to tell us what they'd seen and what happened to them. And by the time the Sun newspaper had put that front page out, I was on reception again, and people were coming. I think it was the Tuesday. People were coming in with their Sun newspaper and banging it on the desk. And by the end of the day, I had a stack about this big of Sun newspapers next to me. And people were just saying, do something about that, do something about that. And Roger Phillips is he's just retired actually, but was a great broadcaster then and carried on for years and really took rightly took the side of the Hillsborough families, gave them space to have their campaign. Gave them a voice, yeah.
Yeah.
And they were all coming in saying, I want to talk to Roger, I want to talk to Roger. You know, he was the person that they knew would hear them. It was just day after day after day after day of people either coming in or calling in. and saying what they had seen or saying what had happened to them or responding to the reaction to them. And in amongst it, there was some, you're talking about conversations. Not all of those conversations were on air. I had an amazing conversation with, I mean, because I wasn't on air at the time.
No.
You know, but I mean, subsequently, I, as a journalist, I'd covered Hillsborough loads of times, you know, the fight for justice loads of
you
times.
You still do, Sheila.
I do. I do.
You've become a megaphone for those families and all of the people that suffered that loss. And you've never stopped telling that story. And you've done it in such a considered and smart fashion, and I applaud you for that.
Well, thank you.
Because it's 30 years of constantly keeping the volume turned up on it.
Yeah, and but the family did that, you know, the families did that. They are like one family, but the families did that, which is, and again, but you're right, lots of journalists ignored it.
So, you know, when the headlines burn out, you know, they move off to the next story. Somebody has to keep the attention. Well, somebody has to keep making people feel compelled to listen.
Well, Radio Merseyside absolutely did that. Mm. And a good friend of mine, Pauline McAdam, she's just finished a 6-part. She'd been doing it over a couple of years because for legal reasons, she had to press pause on them. But anyone who wants to know the truth about Hillsborough should listen to this podcast series. It's a 6-part podcast series on BBC Sounds. One of the conversations I had in that week has never left me. And it was because of what the upshot of it was. It was a kind of happy upshot in a sad story. This man came I know how old he was. He told me he was in his 70s, 74. He came in, and I'm just a kid, really. I've only just graduated. You know, and he comes into to the reception and he said, Is Roger here? And I said, he is, but he's on the, with everyone looking for Roger. I said, he's on the radio. He's on air at the moment. Can I help at all? And he said, I was at the match on Saturday. And I said, you okay? Because a lot of it, we had counsellors, priests, you know,
so
carers.
Traumatic what people saw.
People forgot that most of the victims were children.
Yeah.
They were under 18. Yeah. And they had blood alcohol tests, as we now know. Well, I knew that on the Saturday evening because their families were telling me, you know, so I knew that. Hours after Hillsborough, loads of people did, and then lots of people just changed the narrative to suit their purposes. But this man said he was 74, lovely older guy at the time, you know, had like an old man look. He told me that he'd been in the Leppings Lane because we just wanted to check if people came in, it's because they wanted to talk, you know. And I said, do you have anyone at home? And he said, I have my wife, but I told her a fib. I told her I was somewhere else and that I was fine. And he said, and I am fine because I'm all right. He said, I'm covered in bruises and da, da, da. And I said, what is it? How can we help you? You know, and he said, I'm trying to find these two lads who helped me and I don't know. Don't be crying, you'll set me off.
No.
And he said, I'm trying to find these two lads who helped me. And he said, I don't know who they are. And they threw me over the gate, you know, the fence. And he said, and the only thing I can tell you about them is that they kept calling me Pops. And which isn't really a very Scouse word for a granddad or not. He didn't think so. And I didn't think so. And he said, that's all I remember. And I said, well, I think you might be in luck. Because I had literally 10 minutes before heard a man talking to Roger Phillips on the phone in. And I didn't remember the detail of that the young lad was describing, but I remembered the word Pops. And it was literally 10 minutes before. Uh-huh. So I said, come through. So I sat him down with the people there was a room where people could go and talk and be given a cup of tea and wait. And I ran into Roger's team and I said, 3 calls ago, or however many calls ago, this guy, young, have you got his number? Got his number. Rang him. And I said, I think I might have this man that you helped with me. And he said, I'm coming down. So he came down to Radio Mersey. So it took about an hour. Reunion.
Uh-huh.
I know you're crying. Don't make me cry.
Because Hillsborough is all about loss and you forget about those moments. Mm-hmm. Because those people went to see a football match.
Yeah.
Nobody was there for anything other than that.
Yeah, exactly.
And everybody tried to help one another. And to hear that,
beautiful.
It's just a chink of lovely humanity.
Honestly,
in amongst it all.
Really lovely. I was at the 20th anniversary in Anfield doing live broadcasting of
it. Is this when you did your 10 minutes with no guests?
That was at LBC.
You were brilliant,
that was
Sheila.
LBC.
I think that's some of the most powerful broadcasting I've ever heard.
Really?
Honestly. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's nice of you.
It was wonderful. And just to give context to anyone who's listening, but you did 10 minutes where you recapped everything that you understood Hillsborough to be.
And how the families had always used the law and the institutions that had failed them to try to put it right.
Yeah.
They never put a foot wrong. And how they kept that discipline up. I can't say for sure that I wouldn't have been putting bricks through people's windows by that
but
point.
They didn't.
And they never did.
They outclassed everybody.
Everybody.
And you told their story and you did it in a way. I can't remember where I was. I pulled over. I was driving. I just stopped and I remember just staring at my steering wheel, listening to you.
Really?
And crying. Because
I cried afterwards. Not
because
at the time.
Because it was such an injustice.
It was.
And it's taken so long. And everybody plays a part in this, and you've played an integral part. And I think as a journalist, I wonder when you look back at that, being a party to those conversations and then seeing the misreporting, the injustice, I wonder if that set the fire in your belly that continues to burn to this day and made you the broadcaster and journalist that you are.
I wonder. It might well have. And I remember when I... that was April, wasn't it, Hillsborough? And then I started my BBC course in September, so the interviews were intervening. And I remember my old Spanish professor writing a reference for the course, you know, and by which time Hillsborough had already happened. And I'd included in my letter to him that I'd covered it as a support staff, really, you know. And he said, I think Sheila will have learnt everything there is to learn about the good, the bad and the indifferent in journalism from this very story. Yeah. And yes, and I think he was right. So well observed.
I think if you are immersed in a story and you are a party to what you were, and then you see what's going on, that must give you a determination to constantly question
and
hold to account.
And you know, I said on the day, I think it was the day that, I nearly said Boris Johnson, David Cameron, it was 2012, the Hillsborough Independent Panel report come out, and David Cameron apologised in the House of Commons. I don't know whether you remember that.
Yes, I do.
And he outlined everything that panel had found, you know. And I said on air, and I'm at the BBC at the time, and my editor rightly said, I know you know the story and you have an understanding of the story, but you're broadcasting to people who don't as well. It was really good advice to make me really think before I...
And also people forget, so you need to recap it.
Completely,
you need to
yeah. And when the report had been outlined by Cameron, and then he apologised, and he did the whole thing beautifully, there was just a point where I suddenly thought, this this is kind of very pre-LBC, but there was a point where I just thought, it's in the parliamentary record now, what happened on that day.
So now you can raise it, right?
Screw this, I'm saying what I like, you know, and I said what I liked. And I just said, I said, from today, in that outline of what that report found, and in Cameron's apology and everything, I learned one thing that I didn't know within 2 days of Hillsborough happening. I learned one thing only.
Which was
the numbers of people that could have been saved. That's all I learned. Practically by the evening of Hillsborough, everything that was in that report was known. And it took 26 years, was it, before
Maybe
that came out?
20, yeah.
Whatever it was. And, you know... I just remember thinking, right, now's my moment. And I just said, you have to understand that this was common knowledge. And not only was it common knowledge among survivors and families and spouses, it was common knowledge because within a year of Hillsborough happening, Lord Justice Taylor produced a report that said essentially the same thing.
Yes, he did.
And you're like, why did everybody forget that? Of course, there's relief and release in the truth being out there, but there's no accountability for it.
There is no accountability. And that is, and there's no comfort. You can't replace what these people have lost.
No, you can't.
And it's not just the lives that they've lost. It's the years of fight
peace
and struggle,
mind.
The peace of
All
mind.
All lost peace of mind. I mean, a cab driver was driving me on the day of the independent panel. I was telling him what I was going to be reporting on that day. And he started to cry in the cab. And he said, I was there on the day with my brother. And he said, and I lost him for half an hour. Couldn't find him on the pitch. Found him on the pitch injured, but he was alive, which is good. I said, don't worry. I said, you're going to hear today that the fans, you're going to hear again today that the fans were not to blame for this. And he said, that's so important to me. Sometimes in the middle of the night, I've wondered, I've thought, did we hurt each other?
But that's what they do.
Did we? Because they sowed that seed.
But also because we're raised to believe what authority tells us. We're raised to believe that if the newspapers say it, well, there must be some truth in it.
On that question of authority, actually, on the day that Cameron gave that apology, one of the most interesting comments on the day in the debate that followed was from the former attorney, Dominic Grieve. He was the attorney general that gave the green light for the full independent panel, to take place, the second set of inquests. And he said, and I thought it was so shrewd and so wise, this Hillsborough and what happened and the institutions that contributed to what happened, both the event and the cover-up, shame us all. I'm paraphrasing him massively here, but he said they shame us all, and we need to remind ourselves, and this is really contingent on events now, I think, we need to remind ourselves that the institutions that Britain trumpets about and says how British institutions are the strongest in democracies around the world, la la la, and in some senses they are. But he said the institutions have to serve the people, and they certainly have no place harming people and lying about people and upending people's lives. That's not what they're for. They are there to serve people. And the institutions that were meant to serve people that day and beyond hurt them instead, and knowingly hurt them.
Grievously let them down.
Really, but he was brilliant. And he said that this should be a warning to us all about our institutions. All of them, not just the ones involved in Hillsborough. And my God, was he right? Because look at our institutions at the moment.
Yeah. I hope you're listening, Sue Gray.
Yeah. And Dominic Grieve, come back.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for sharing so much of that, because to have played such an integral part in unearthing so many mistruths and correcting that, it's really important, Sheila. And as journalists, I think, you know, you start at the beginning of the, you know, the kind of the foothills of your career thinking you're going to be a great, you know, purveyor of the truth and injustice. And actually very rarely do you get a chance to do that. And yeah, you
and
have.
To be honest, I'm not sure I unearthed anything. And it's not false modesty on my part. I'm a good communicator. I'm good at getting stories told by people, if you see what I mean, helping them to tell their story. But actually there were journalists like David Conn in The Guardian, other journalists. There was a great Daily Mirror journalist.
Yes, I know you mean.
Reed, oh my God, to my shame. We've both got middle-aged brain that we can't remember people's
brain fog.
Names. Forgive me, Mr. Reed of The Mirror. People like Roger I've mentioned.
But I think the bit that you forget is when you come on air and you do 10 minutes on this, we know you, we trust you. The BBC, right?
Yeah.
And we've heard you talk about this. We're familiar with your familiarity of this story. Mm-hmm. So when you say something, it carries great weight and responsibility. And I think we forget that sometimes.
But I take, as broadcasters, yeah. But I do take that seriously on that story, seriously.
And I think that you were given great trust by the people and the families that sat around that story, and you never let them down.
I hope not.
So important conversations. That's probably one of the most significant. Yeah. What about in your own life?
29, I'm 29 then, not now, 29, heartbroken, romance had ended. Also very confused because a job I'd gone on, I was doing, hadn't worked out well. And it wasn't because of the job particularly, it was because of me. It was the first time in my life that I'd been really upended by sadness, really. And anyway, relationship over, job I left, was in the middle of sorting out the next one. Which turned out to be a job presenting The Breakfast Show at Radio Merseyside, which then led me to presenting full-time, which was never my plan.
So actually all very huge moments in your life. First heartbreak.
First job crash.
Yeah.
You know, and they turned, I suppose my efforts went some way to turning it around, but it's funny, isn't it? I think there's a lot of hope in that story because I really was not in a good place. And the idea that was the point that led me to the rest of my career and life. It really was, you know, and it's an interesting one. I was staying at my mum's and dad's for a few months because I'd left London and was coming back up to Liverpool and working out what to do next. Always go home in a crisis. And my dad was a great guy. He'd remind you of Terry Wogan in some ways, a bit rough around the edges.
See, my mum and dad, both Irish, arrived in Liverpool in the 50s, is that
late
right?
50s, yeah, 58. Yeah. And sadly, both lost to us now, but never lost. You know, it's like, they're never lost, are they? But Dad was funny as hell, and he was also very wise and very warm. He found me in the middle room of the house crying. 29, it's not like I'm 17 here, you know, 29. And he said, she, are you crying again? And I was going, oh, Dad, you know. And he said, now look, she, he said, how old are you? And I thought he was saying, how old are you? In that sort of rhetorical way, but he literally had forgotten.
Because he's got seven kids.
Like,
you're lucky he remembered your name.
And he said, how old are you? And I said, I know. And he went, no, how old are you? And I said, 29, 29. And he said, well, and this is my dad talking, right? He said, if I was 29 and had your brains and your opportunities, and God love him, he was my dad, and your looks, he said, I wouldn't be crying, Sheila. And I was going, I know, but still intent on crying, you know. And he said to me, honestly, Sheila, he said, stop it now. And it was the best sort of example I've ever had of tough love where he wasn't mean, he didn't raise his voice, anything like that. He just said, listen, enough now, enough. And he did enough just to reveal that he was a little bit sick and tired of me.
Yeah. You
know? Still loved me, still being kind.
But that's enough now.
But I was being a bit of a bore. And I was. And I needed someone to tell me. And he said, enough now, Sheila. He said, listen, you know what you're going to need to do? And I said, what am I going to need to do? And he said, you're going to need to remember who you are. And he said, me and your mum are going out now. And then they went out. That was it. You're going to need to remember who you are. And it's such good advice, isn't it?
So at the tail end of a relationship, especially one that ends with great sadness, that's really pertinent advice because you have forgotten who you are and you have to reset.
You have to remake yourself. You're the same person, obviously, but you have to remake yourself. And I think it's not even about romance. I've used it so many times in my life where you just think, okie dokie. You know, if you're just like not making a decision or you've let things slide in a particular area.
Put yourself together.
You're just like, hang on. Who are you here? You know, and when I lost mum, which was only last September, we lost mum. Last September, I put a little Instagram post up about it. Just it's a good way to let people know where you're at and why you're not on air for 5 weeks and whatever. I looked back on it the other day and I noticed that I'd said in it, because I couldn't remember it at that point. I said in it how lucky I was to be hers is how I described it. And how I'd spend the rest of my life, not much left, Kate.
That's not true.
No, I know. Spend the rest of my life trying to live up to that good fortune. And I saw it the other day and I thought,
so poetic.
But isn't it a good choice? If you know you've been raised by fabulous people, the two bits of advice they gave me that really stand out, you know, that really, not advice, mum wasn't so much about advice, but the dad just said, remember who you are. And I come away from losing my mum thinking, I'm going to live up to everything she was. That's what I'm going to do. And who needs a map if you've got that? That's
got
the map.
Two bookends of great advice there, right?
It's the map, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the map.
But all of which takes me really nicely to my next question, actually.
Go on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
In lockdown, you moved back to Liverpool to be with your mum.
Yeah.
And as you've just said, sadly, she passed away last September.
Not of COVID.
We
protected her from COVID. I mean, she had other issues that, you know, she was 90 when she died.
My goodness, a good innings.
And
I mean,
ready
as they
to
say.
Go, you know, and it's, you know.
Seven children. I mean, not a patch on your great grandmother who had how many?
My dad's grandmother had
18?
18 children.
I mean, that's almost
a
class.
I've got a photograph of this woman. She looks fantastic.
You put it on Twitter. I zoomed in on her. She hadn't even got two chins. It's like, what?
When I was 4 and a half, we moved house from the house I'd lived in Anfield for the first 4 years of my life to the house that we are just selling, sadly, because of mum passing away. And I'm the only one of us that went to nursery for any length of time because they were sorting out the house and moving house. Six kids in school, one renegade still in the house. So they thought, well, nursery for a bit while mum sorts out the house. Anyway, they moved house and forgot to collect me from nursery.
I mean, it's a numbers game.
How's that for abandonment issues? And I'll never forget it. Whenever I tell the story at Christmas, mum would be like, ah, Sheila Dawn. She never lived it down, abandoning me as a small child.
So, this time that you had in the pandemic, back home, broadcasting from your mum's bedroom.
My bedroom. My childhood bedroom.
Yeah, your childhood bedroom.
My sister-in-law, by the way, printed off for me posters of Starsky and Hutch, The Police. You'll love this one. Starsky and Hutch, The Police, Donny Osmond, and can you guess the last one?
No.
Good Catholic Girl.
The Pope?
Yeah.
Oh, you're joking me.
Pope John Paul II. One of my heroes.
One of the all-time favourites.
One of the all-time favourites. Well, he was in some charts. Yeah.
So you go back home to broadcast and to care for your mum. And I'd imagine, you know, these were unknown times, unprecedented. Yeah. But fundamentally, you're there because, you know, you want to keep her safe.
Yeah.
And with the hindsight that you have now, this was precious, right? These were gold bars in terms of your memory.
I knew even then it was, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, my brother Liam lived around the corner, so the two of us split the caring. So when I was on air,
he would come in.
But the others, once we could, you know, the others would come.
It wouldn't have been allowed.
No, they'd come to the window and wave and stand by the kitchen door. It was terrible, really. And mum would start to think they'd died. And, you know, this is the kind of pressure people were under, which is why the Partygate thing makes my blood boil. But I knew, you know, even though I was doing 3 hours solid every day, and as I said earlier, taking lots of, you know, distressed calls and things, my colleagues would say to me from time to time, you know, okay, but a bit intense what you're doing, you know, and I said, I'm absolutely fine. And I was fine. And I was fine because I had my job, and lots of people didn't, and I was where I wanted to be to keep my mum safe and that. So I had everything I needed at that phase, really. It was intense and I'd sometimes just, you know, flop on the bed and think, oh my God.
What am I doing?
So tiring, you know, but, you know, it wasn't just me doing it, but it was, but I was living with mum and it was so nice. You're absolutely right to say it was precious because I was going up a lot anyway. Most weekends I was there and holidays and things, but it was so precious because we just kind of hunkered down together, you know, and it was a bit like being, obviously there were different dynamics at play, but it's a bit like being flatmates and housemates. And we'd have a giggle and, you know, she had tough times because of the physical stuff she was going through. And so I'd help her with that emotionally. And, you know, and it was an emotional time, but utterly magical as well.
It enabled you to probably say all the things you needed to say, totally. Laugh at all the jokes that you needed to revisit.
Yeah.
Be there. It was a full stop that so many people were denied in the pandemic.
You know what? I hugged her about 85,000 times a day. And because before they said the word bubble, we were in a bubble, you know. And I just got so much time to hug her and squeeze her and
love her.
And I love her and do her hair. I became the hairdresser. I wasn't that bad. When I first did, you know, when you put like 90 rollers in old lady's hair, that style, that's all I can do. If you ever want
a set,
that, I'm your woman.
A set. I used to do those in my Auntie Jill's salon.
Yeah, I couldn't believe
and then brush them out,
it.
But it stays all day. So Margaret Thatcher kept her so big and
it's
high.
It's true.
Set in lotion. But I still love the smell of it.
You do my hair and I say, I will.
But those are difficult times, but precious times.
Incredibly.
And I wondered, when else great difficulties have turned into great treasures for you?
Gosh, that's a tough one. Just because there's so... You know, there's so many examples in life, aren't there, where you just think, right, how am I going to manage this? How am I going to handle this? But something that turned out to be a gift, well, actually that, you know, what I've just described with mum, without a doubt, has taught me a huge amount. I never had a burning desire to have children. I never had a burning desire not to have children. You know, I'm quite
ambivalent.
I don't even have ambivalence about it.
Indifference?
Yeah, kind of. I love kids and I've got loads of nieces and nephews and a couple of godchildren, a few godchildren, and I adore them. You know, I'd do anything for them. It was just, I think I'm just a bit of a sort of, oh, that next and that's interesting and that's interesting. The idea of settling down and having a family, it was no driver. It was not a driver of mine.
Too much of a butterfly.
In my 20s. A bit. Yeah, I think so. And it's never really stopped. So I never felt the clock ticking. I never thought, God, am I doing this right? Or, you know, because, and I think I'm just naturally interested in being alive and living. So if it involves children, great. If it involves husbands, great. Well, not two, obviously. Well, not at the same time anyway. You know, if it involves those things, fine. And if it doesn't, also fine.
Yeah.
Live, just live.
Yeah.
And so that's been my, that was always my approach to kids. It wasn't even an approach to kids. It's an approach to life in which that was inevitably. But it's an interesting one because there are so many ways in which life tells you you should do X, Y, or Z. It's not just about motherhood, and it's not even just for women either. It's for men. I just think if we could all just take a breath and say, what am I interested in? What do I want to do?
Well, yeah, well, then pursuing what you think is,
what actually drives me.
Prescribed for you by society as opposed to actually what makes your heart beat, right?
Yeah. And also, if you fall in love and your heart beats and you want to have a baby with somebody,
great.
And had that happened, I'd have gone for it like a shot. Yeah. But it just wasn't that order for me, you know what I mean? So it's never bothered me. But what did bother me was by the time I was about, I don't know, late 30s, maybe mid-30s, lots of people, almost exclusively women, and some friends as well, would really quiz me on it. And it really fucked me off when they did that. And I'd be like, I'm sorry, when I walk through a door, do you just see the absence of a baby or do you see me? You know, what is it you're seeing when I walk through the door here, you know? And it, for a brief period, it really got on my nerves. And I'd go to like, I went to a christening once and I was holding a baby at a christening, not unknown, a friend's baby while they were having their pictures taken. And a woman came up to me, we were just chatting, mingling, perfectly nice woman. And she asked a perfectly normal question. She said, oh, is this your little girl? And I said, no, oh no, I wish. I was being nice about little Bella and da, 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 da. And she said to me, well, do you have children? Also a normal question. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a normal question. And I said, no, I don't actually. And she went, your life must be terrible.
Pity. Did she cock her head to one side?
Like a screw the nose thing. Up. Yeah.
And a screwy nose.
I spoke to Jane Fallon about this, you know, the author Jane Fallon. I was interviewing her once and we were talking about this issue. And I said, the woman at the christening said to me, oh, so it went from a nice normal conversation to, oh dear, is your life shit? And I just said, actually, I couldn't stand it anymore. I'd had like 6 months of this nonsense. So I just said, God love this woman. She didn't mean any harm. But I just said, I did have two actually. And then she went, oh. And you could see this horror in her face, like, oh my God, what happened to the die? What happened to the kids? And I said, reaching for my wine, I said, social services took them off me. and that began a short, thankfully short, psychotic period of doing my level best to make people who ask me those questions as uncomfortable as possible. And when I told Jane Fallon this, she was like, oh, I'm including that in the book. I said, feel free.
Have it.
Get the message out there. Leave us the fuck alone. I think it's good that women can now say they don't want them. That was never
That's
my
okay.
thing. Mine was just like, I'm going to live and see where it takes me. That's my approach to these things. And a bit of a hippie on the quiet, I suppose.
Are people that insensitive still that they come in and they crash in with those sort of questions, Sheila?
They've stopped now because they've decided my ovaries are a non-starter. But I think you ask most 35-plus-year-old women who don't have kids how often people ask them about it. I'll bet it's loads still.
Yeah.
But that phase of life added to the time I had with my mum, you know, this very meaningful time I had with my mum. I did have, and I'm hoping to write about it. I'm not ready to, when I say I'm not ready, I mean I haven't quite formulated it properly in my mind because it's in my heart still rather than in my mind. I did have a real sort of, what's it, like a sort of resolution in my mind about how all of that connects, all of that question of what we do with our life, whether we for women, whether we become a mother or not, what it is to be a mother. And my mother was some mother and had seven kids, as we've said a few times. She was an extraordinary mother. You know, she really was, but in a very light touch way. And because of the generation she was from in Ireland, the country she was from, the generation she was from, you got married. If you were fertile enough to have kids, you had lots of kids. That was just, that was the deal, you know. And I was in one of my brother's wedding speeches once, they were reading the litany of, you know, mum and dad came here in 1950, there's six kids. So Sheila was born in 1966. And then they got a telly as though that was the conversation. You know? But she, I was just thinking at the end, towards the end of her life, you know, she took everything. She had much fewer choices than you or I would have had in our life. And she took everything as it came and in her stride. And you know, and that was child after child after child after child for 7 years. And dad, you know, he had to keep those kids alive as well, you know.
Yeah, and fed.
And clothed. Fed and clothed and all the rest of it. I mean, it really, she really is of that Irish Catholic tradition. And that, you know, that bit in the Bible where it says, you never hear the only words the Virgin Mary says in the Bible is about the wine, you know, go and get some more wine, which I rather like.
My kind of girl.
The Virgin Mary of the podcast world, yeah. And but they would often say, you know, she pondered these things in her heart, you know, this is in the Bible. And I'd say to my mum, when I was a kid and knew nothing, I'd say to mum, and I say kid, I was like teenager, I'd say, what's all this business about Our Lady never saying anything? And pondering everything in her heart, but not saying it, not saying anything.
Like a mute.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, I was seeing it through that really harsh feminist perspective, if you see what I mean. I'm not saying feminism is harsh, you know what I mean? Sort of clean lines. And mum would just say, you don't always have to say everything, Sheila. And I was like, have you met me? And you gave birth to me, have you met me? But she'd say, you know, people don't always have to say everything that's on their mind, you know, and then as things, you know, and then over the years, obviously I wasn't actively observing her, if you see what I mean, but over the years observing her, and then certainly in these last few years, I've realized that what she did, and it's so counterintuitive to me because I am a talker, you know, I'm a real talker. Everything she said landed. Because she had pondered it in her heart first, you know, when it came to the raising of her kids, I mean, and their marriages, she most adored mother-in-law on the planet because she didn't interfere or she understood that where the lines were drawn, you know. And I think that much time spent with her in these last few years, and also I suppose my own maturity as well, has just taught me that there are, for all the noise in this world at the moment, and there's a lot of it, I'm making quite a bit of it myself, you know, that actually we've got to find space in between all that noise to ponder these things in our heart and to just really work out what you want to say and why, you know.
But I said right at the beginning of this show, I think you're one of our most considered broadcasters because that is how I hear you, Sheila.
Is it?
I don't think
that's my mum coming through there.
And I think that's exactly it, right? Is that you probably think you say a lot, but I think actually you may well say a lot, but what you say is very considered. And
it rubbed off in the end.
Yeah, inadvertently.
It's there.
So very much your mother's daughter.
In that
respect.
And my dad's in that.
Yeah.
Gabbing away. As my dad used to say on my headstone, it would say, too busy talking.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. It's okay. No.
My final question to you.
Go on.
You are thrust into partnerships with people on air, where you have to become professional friends.
Yeah.
And I talked about this again recently we had Carol McGiffin on the show and how we were kind of professional friends that grew into genuine mates, right? And I learned a lot from being forced to get along with people that would have otherwise sat outside my tribe. Yeah. You've worked with some incredible people across the years.
Yeah.
Who have been the biggest teachers? What have been the biggest kind of values and takeouts from those enforced professional friendships?
Yeah. Are you talking about on-air friendships? Particularly?
Anything. But you know, even if it's working with a producer, it's just somebody that brings something to the table that otherwise would not be there in your world.
Well, more than anyone, Nicky Campbell. More than anyone. I mean, I knew he was, because when I first started to broadcast at 5 Live, it would have been year 2000 pretty much.
You were just a jobbing freelancer then, weren't you?
Yeah, I'd only just left my staff job at the BBC, came down to London, big brave girl. And actually what I was doing was having another go because the professional car crash that coincided with the romance car crash when I was 29 felt to me like a failure. It wasn't, as it turned out. It was just an event, you know. And I thought, I've got to go back and give that another go. And this was the way I did it, by going back and freelancing as a presenter. I just had unfinished business, you know, and I was right. I did have unfinished business because I've never left. So there you go. And so I had hardly done anything on air at 5 Live. And I stood in on this, forgive me if any 5 Livers are listening, ludicrous program that sat for 40 minutes in the middle of Nicky's brilliant 3-hour program in the morning. Pretty sure I got the gig temporarily, because I could pronounce the names of all the foreign newspapers, like the Deutsche Zeitung, the German one. But my favourite was Corriere della Sera. I just suddenly became Gina Lollobrigida when I said that.
Yeah. Italiano.
So, but the presenter at the time said to me, Nicky, I didn't know Nicky at all. I mean, I knew him on air and, you know, as a person, but as a personality, but I didn't know him. And he said, Nicky hates this. He hates this programme. So good luck. Great.
Brilliant. Yeah. Amazing.
And why wouldn't he hate it? If somebody said to me now in the middle of my program, we're going to stop at 20 to 2 or at 10, whatever, it's 2:15. And until 3 o'clock, we're going to do a program about Brussels. I'd be like, oh, nice try. Give it a go. See what the callers make of it. Nicky surprises people because he gets a terrible bad rap sometimes from people, I think. And I always, literally always found him to be pitch perfect with me and just brilliant to work alongside. But this was the first day I ever did, and did my European thing. I said foreign names a bit, and I would leave at 11 o'clock. That would be the end of it, and then he'd finish his program. And during the news, he did keep his head down quite a lot while I was doing it. Why wouldn't he? Just probably prepping for his own things. And then he said to me at 11 o'clock, bear in mind, we'd never met until that day, and he said, listen, would you stay on for 15 minutes. I've got an interview coming up. And he said, it's quite strange. He said, it's a book written by a woman who's had a miscarriage, and she has written it in the voice of the child that she's lost.
Wow.
And he said, and I don't know whether it's a good, I've read it. And he said, and I can't work out whether it's good and interesting spiritually and personally, or whether it's just a bit off. I can't work it out. He said, I think a woman in the room would be really helpful as well. So feel free to join in on the interview. So I said, okay. Great. So I did. And I read the book subsequently, but the woman was made perfect sense about how she was describing this voice she would never hear, this child she would never know. So I just liked him. And I thought, yeah, I really like working with you. I like that moment of working with you.
Yeah.
A couple of days later, did it again. And do you remember the day of the full solar eclipse where we all went outside and went, oh, it's gone cold. And
God,
then it was fine again.
Years ago, isn't it?
Oh, God, 2000.
Oh, my God, 22 yeah, years ago. How depressing.
And
I was thinking more like five or six.
I did Euro News, right? And he hated it, obviously. And we were, you know, we were accustomed to each other by this point. And he said to me just before the news, tell you what, because we were talking about the eclipse at midday, you know, coming up at midday, and it was 11 now. And he said, tell you what, Sheila, why don't you stay? I'll go downstairs with everybody else and watch the eclipse, and you can have your big break and present the rest of my program and da, da, da. And I just said, talk about cheek. I said, don't need my big break that badly. I'm going to go and watch the universal solar eclipse, if that's all right. And off I went, you know, and he took it well. And he missed the eclipse, and I'm out there loving it. And and I thought, no work.
That's some
no money. Yeah. I have a friend. No, screw you. I don't need a big break. You know, I did, by the way. But I actually think my biggest break was 4 years later when I started to present with him full time, because I'd stood in a lot for Victoria Derbyshire at that point. So Nicky and I had established a rapport, and he used to make me die. Well, he does make me die laughing still, because we're very, like you and Carol, we've got a real friendship.
It goes beyond, yeah, the show, yeah.
But he's such a good broadcaster. He could turn anything into a decent bit of radio, I think. And more than a decent bit of radio. I used to have to send him out of the studio sometimes because I couldn't read out loud without laughing.
Isn't that
and
great?
Yeah, we had such a hoot. And he's also very, very kind, really kind man.
So. I think it's special sometimes, especially when you don't know what to expect. No, it's kind of like pass the parcel professionally.
It is.
You just keep unlayering and unwrapping.
I won't name them, but I've had a few where I've thought, get me out of this room. Oh my God, that was hard work. You know,
yeah.
And there really is something.
But you can't get on with everybody.
No,
you just can't.
You can't. I mean, I've done.
And you've worked with some pretty big characters. I mean, Andrew Neil. You worked with Andrew just as he came out of newspapers, where he was, you know, king of the news. Room, you know, the floor responded to him. He's the editor
and
of the
I
Sunday
knew
Times.
Even then he knew where the bodies were buried, many of them, you know. Mm. And I mean, he was, you know, I was very young when I did that, and you know, and he was clearly much the more experienced person. And he didn't lord that over me or anything. He was pleasant enough to present with, for sure. Nick Robinson, I used to do weekend breakfast with him, and he was great to work alongside. I had At LBC, I've done two royal broadcasts with Nick Ferrari.
Ah, I used to work with Nick.
Oh, he's so good. And he was this moment during...
He's a lovely man.
Oh, yeah. And
a great journalist.
Proper journalist, proper broadcaster. And there was a moment during the Harry and Meghan's wedding. I love a royal wedding. I don't know whether I've ever bored you about this. Love a royal wedding. You know how beautiful Windsor Castle is, and there was this beautiful scene because we were on the what's it called, the long walk,
long walk,
and we had a TV screen in front of us, and there's this gorgeous television shot through the archway into Windsor Great Park. I can't remember what was coming through the archway or anything, but it was just such a beautiful shot. And I just said to, I was talking to Nick about whatever, and I just went, oh, look at that. And he just tapped me on the arm and went, you're on the radio, Shields. You've got to tell them what you're looking at. I was so immersed in it all.
And lost yourself.
Look at the carriages, look at the dress, look at the bride, look at the groom. Oh, isn't that lovely? Look at that. And he's like, tell people what you're looking at, Shields. And I was going, oh, yeah.
Talking pictures.
Rule 101. So, yeah, that was good fun. So, yeah.
What have these people taught you, do you think? Because I don't believe that you can work with anybody in that intense environment that you do in broadcast, especially live broadcast, and not be impacted by them one way or another.
Well, can I say about Nicky, I think, because he has definitely had the biggest impact. I'd come from straight down the line news journalism, and he'd come from entertainment. I mean, I'd done a bit of presenting at Radio Merseyside, but and I was probably a fairly... I'm probably a bit too lazy to be anything other than my authentic self when I'm on the radio. I'm just me on the radio, you know. How do you create a persona? I don't know.
I don't think you can fake
for 3 hours a day. It's so intimate, isn't it? You just can't. So whatever, it was me. I'm not saying I knew nothing when I started working with Nicky. That's not true. But I certainly had a lot of style development to go. And by that, I mean working... just as I've done at LBC, working out what to keep, working out what to drop. And then you just naturally shed skins without noticing really in a relationship on air, don't you? But what I saw with Nicky, and sometimes it was very deliberate. I was seeing how he did it. And other times it's just by osmosis when you broadcast with somebody. He is so fluent in how he moves gear. He can change gear so brilliantly. And I was in one gear, but I was in news gear, you know? And quite quickly... working with him, even in those little early days of doing Euronews, I learned to just relax a little.
Soften your edges.
Exactly. Yeah. And Nicky was the perfect partner to do that with because he has so many gears that he can go into on air. And it allowed me to go into those gears into my version of those gears as well. So,
do you miss working alongside somebody? Because I've had a bit of both as of you.
Yeah.
And I'm happiest when I'm shoulder to shoulder with somebody, I think.
When I went solo, because I did 2 years on the midday show at Five Live after leaving Breakfast, because I was just knackered on Breakfast and Nicky's never forgiven me. And now I'm on air every day on my own. But I'm not, because the listeners are your co-presenters, really.
They are.
They are, aren't they? I mean, because I'm constantly in conversation with mostly my listeners or a guest. So you kind of... in a way, have that co-presenting person there as well. So, yeah. But I did definitely miss I was constantly looking for where he was. What I have got, and I'm still getting from my LBC programme, is just my programme to make of it what I want. Mm. And I have to say, they were brilliant. When I first got there, I was still very much a BBC creature in terms of my muscles, you know. And they gave me the time. I'm sure I frustrated them with the time I took, but they gave me the time to just find my way into that way of broadcasting. You know, Hillsborough, they saw what you described that day. And I remember that my producer at the time said, do you want me to get you a guest on that? The story just broke. And he said, do you want me to get you a guest on that? And I said, nope, I do not need a guest on this. And it was the first time I'd ever gone, nope, open the mic and I'll do it. Yeah. Because I really had something I wanted to say.
Save me up.
Well, and that's what LBC hired me for, really, you know. But it takes a while to get to that space where you're just saying, right, here I am, this is mine, and this is what I'm going to do with it.
And you know you're a really important voice at LBC. You're also a rare female voice at LBC. I hope that that's something that is balanced in the years to come. Not that I want boxes ticked, but
I think
you're proof that 3 hours of conversation can be stained by somebody wearing a bra.
Girls can do it.
We can,
absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
We can. We're quite good at chatting.
Yeah. So girls can do it. Women can do it. You know, what's lovely about LBC is that Nick will have particular conversations with his listeners that are about them. They've called him.
Yeah.
So that they won't, that they're not looking for a conversation with me at that time. They're looking for a conversation with him.
Yeah.
And when they call me, it's because they want to talk to me.
You know, I love listening to you, Sheila. I look for, if I jump in the car and it's between 1 and 4, I'm like, oh, brilliant, Sheila's on.
So good for my ego.
Honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure. I was almost frightened to ask you to come on the show in case
I don't do socials.
Well, no, and just in case we didn't get on as well as I hoped we would.
Oh, no, it's been
And you've been everything I'd hoped for. So
and I'm really not trying to be a mystery online, so let's see.
Well, let's see if
put this out there, see what happens.
Exactly. But cheers and continued success in all that you do. Yeah. My huge thanks to Sheila. And if you're in the mood for more brilliant conversations with some great fellow Radioheads, we've got a back catalogue heaving with them, with the likes of David Lammy MP, Simon Mayo, Chris Moyles, Gabby Roslin's in there, Craig Charles, Reverend Kate Botley, Anita Rani, Dave Berry, Nikki Chapman. I mean, I could go on, but I won't. White Wine Question Time is produced by me, Kate Thornton, with Ben Robbins and the Yahoo Studios team. And our music is, as always, by Andy Bell, whose new solo record, Glock, has just topped the dance charts. Take that, Andy Bell. We'll be back next week with more great guests. Until then, my thanks to you, as always, for listening in.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.